Osho, Sufis, the People of the Path, Volume 1. Talks on Sufism given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 8.
The first question. Why do you give sannyas to babies and children? Sannyas can be given only to babies and children. The very idea of being an adult is a barrier. The alert mind is an adulterated mind. It is already corrupt. The physical is irrelevant. Somebody may be 70 years old and yet a baby. And somebody may be young and may not be innocent. To receive sannyas needs a very, very innocent mind, one who knows nothing. Then the contact is immediate, and the contact is from being to being, heart to heart. Otherwise the contact remains from mind to mind, and mind to mind there is no contact really. It is a deception. It only appears as if there is a contact. There is a constant conflict between two minds. Listen to this small story. One evening, Cards, a black cat, who lived at Master Soensa's ashrama, died. The 7-year-old daughter of one of Soensa's disciples was very much troubled by the death. After the burial and chanting to Amida Buddha, she went to Soensa for an interview. Soensa said, "Do you have any questions?" She said, "Yes. What happened to Kartzi? Where did he go?" Soensa said, "Where do you come from?" "From my mother's belly." "Where does your mother come from?" She was silent. Soensa said, "Everything in the world comes from the same one thing. It is like in a cookie factory. Many different kinds of cookies are made. Lions, tigers, elephants, houses, people. They all have different shapes and different names, but they are all made from the same dough, and they all taste the same. So all the different things that you see, a cat, a person, a tree, the sun, this floor, all these things are really the same. What are they? People give them many different names. When you are thinking, all things have different names and different shapes. But when you are not thinking, all things are the same. There are no words for them. People make the words. A cat does not say, 'I am a cat.' People say, 'This is a cat.' The sun does not say, 'My name is sun.' People say, 'This is the sun.' So when someone asks you, 'What is this?' how should you answer?" "I should not use words." Soensa said, "Very good. You should not use words. So if someone asks you, 'What is Buddha?' what would be a good answer?" She was silent. Soensa said, "Now you ask me, 'What is Buddha?'" Soensa hit the floor. She laughed. Swainsa said, "Now I ask you, what is Buddha? See, hit the floor. What is God? See, hit the floor. What is your mother? See, hit the floor. What are you? See, hit the floor. Very good. This is what all things in the world are made of. You and Buddha and God and your mother and the whole world are the same." She smiled. Soinsa said, "Do you have any more questions? You still have not told me where cards went." Soinsa leaned over, looked into her eyes and said, "You already understand." She said, "Ah," and hit the floor very hard. Then she laughed. Soinsa said, "Very, very good. That's how you should answer any question. That is the truth." She bowed and left. As she was opening the door, she turned to Soinsa and said, "Master, but I am not going to answer that way when I am in school. I am going to give regular answers." Soinsa laughed. This is a deeper communion than can be possible between two minds. The child understands in a very different way. First, the child has no knowledge. When there is no knowledge, when you know that you don't know, there is opening. When you know, you are closed. When the child asks a question, it is really out of his ignorance. When a grown-up asks a question, it is out of his knowledge. The question may be formulated in the same way, but the quality of the question is utterly different. When a child asks, there is purity. He does not know. That's why he is asking. When a grown-up asks, he knows. He already knows. The question is out of his knowledge. When the question is out of knowledge, it is impossible to answer it. When you already think you know, you are in conflict with anything that is going to be said to you. You have something at stake, your knowledge, your past, your belief, your doctrine, your church. A child has none of these hindrances. That's why Jesus says, unless you are like a child, you will not enter into the kingdom of God. So don't be worried about children, why I give them sannyas. Rather, be worried about yourself. If you are not a child, even if I give you sannyas, you will not receive it. I go on giving sannyas to every kind of person. To say no is not my way. I hope even against hope. Even when I see somebody just like a rock, when I see him closed completely, no way to enter in him, then too I never say no. Who knows? Maybe tomorrow he relaxes. Maybe just this gesture of his that he wants to take sannyas begins a new chapter in his life. Who knows? Things change, people change. Those who are very, very soft become hard. Those who are hard become soft. Life is a constant flux. Maybe in the past, things have happened in such a way that the person has become rock-like. future may be different, may have a different story to tell. Just looking at the past, because a man is just his past. To deny him sannyas because of his past is to deny him any new future, is to deny him any possibility to change. Who am I to deny? So whosoever comes, even a rock-like person, I say yes. To the lowest, the highest remains possible. There is no way to go so far away from God that you cannot turn. Farthest point in existence from God is still in God. We cannot go out of Him. When a child comes, I accept the child. I understand why you have asked. You have asked because I say that the children should not be conditioned. But sannyas is not a conditioning. It is just the opposite. If I don't give the child sannyas, he is going to become a Christian or a Hindu or a Mohammedan. He is going to become somebody which will be far worse. By giving him sannyas, I allow him entry into a new kind of commune, a new kind of religiousness, which is not religion, but just religiousness. I am welcoming him to a new kind of family, where we are not going to impose any dogma. We are only going to give him a milieu. This is totally different. To give a dogma, conditions. To give a milieu is not a conditioning. To give a milieu is just to share. If I have attained something, I can do two things. Either I start conditioning you so that you also attain the same thing. But through conditioning, nothing ever is attained. Or I can start helping to create a milieu, just a climate, where if you want to open, you can open. It is just like the morning. The sun arrives on the horizon. It does not go to each flower. It does not knock at each bird's nest. It does not order that now start singing, the morning has come, now start opening, the morning has come, now be awake. It says nothing. The sun simply stands there. It creates a climate. That warmth, that life-giving warmth, it spreads all over the earth. In that warmth, trees start opening their eyes. Birds start singing again. Flowers open their petals. Nothing is being said. Nothing is being conditioned. Just the presence. When I am giving sannyas to you, child or not, what is going to happen in it? It is just I am allowing you in my presence. I am simply allowing you to become a friend with me. This is just a friendship in which something is possible if you are ready to move. And a child is more ready to move. And a child is more inquiring. And a child still has wondering eyes. And the child is still clean. Nothing is written on his slate yet. Sannyas is not a kind of imprisonment. It is just an attitude to come out of all prisons. So why not the children should be allowed to become sannyasins? I have no creed, no dogma, no catechism. I am simply a prince. In this prince, you can share something. You can partake of me. Everybody is welcome. A child of 3 months and an old man of 90 years, everybody is welcome. Whosoever wants to go on the journey of the unknown is welcome. And all that we teach here, if you can call it teaching, is love and meditation. Both are unconditioning. Both are dehypnotizing. We don't teach a philosophy about love. We simply create the milieu where love can grow. And we don't put a ritualistic, formalistic form of meditation. Just the quality of meditativeness. Once you start drinking little of meditativeness, little of love, you start growing wings. Sannyas is not the end of the journey. It is just the beginning. It is the first step. When you become a Christian, it is the end. When you become a Hindu, it is the end. When you become a Mohammedan, it is the end. Then you can relax. Then you need not worry. You have become a Christian, now it is Christ's duty and responsibility to save you. Now He will do. Now you can go on your own way, you can go on doing your things. You have left the burden on Jesus. He will carry your cross. Nobody can carry your cross. No, not even Jesus. Nobody can save you. How can anybody save you? The moment you start thinking that somebody else is going to save me, you are going to become a slave. The very idea that somebody else is going to save me creates a slavery. I am not a savior. I don't deal in that kind of nonsense. I am not going to save you. You can save yourself. I will make available all that is in me. You can choose anything that you like and you love. And there is no enforced effort here to bring you all into the same mold. You can grow the way it happens to you. My trust is in the individual. I don't trust the crowd. The crowd is by its very nature ugly. My sannyasins are connected with me individually. My sannyasins are not in fact connected to any organization. If you see any kind of organization, that is just like the post office or the railway management. It is not a church. It is just to make me available to you more easily, more comfortably. Otherwise, I will be crowded and it will not be possible to work at all. The organization is there just like a postal department. It is needed. But it is not an institution. Its function is there, its utility is there, but it is not a church. You don't belong to any organization. My sannyasins belong to me. And each sannyasin belongs directly to me. It is not via the organization. The organization is there only to facilitate things. It is not a party, a sect, a church. It is nothing of the kind. And to each individual, my answer is always different. Hence, you will find so many contradictions. I don't have anything fixed. Whenever I face an individual, I reflect him. I see into him. I don't have anything in my mind to enforce. I see into him. I respond to him. When a child comes, I respond in his way. When an old man comes, I respond in his way. And each individual is so unique, so utterly unique, that you cannot give the same answer to everybody. The second question, can a disciple transcend form and be in tune with the essence of the Creator? Why this hankering to transcend form? Form is also of the Creator. Form is also God. In the form also He exists. Nothing is wrong with the form. The problem arises only when you start thinking as if the form is all. There is no need to transcend the form, there is only need to understand it. Form is perfectly beautiful. The body is perfectly beautiful. But don't think that the body is all. There is something more. Something more that is not visible to the eyes. Something deep. It has to be there. The body is the surface. The soul is its depth. These are not two things. God and the world are not two things. The world is His surface. And God is the world's depth. And the depth cannot exist without the surface, remember. And neither the surface can exist without the depth. They are together. They are absolutely together. They are one. It is only in language that the division arises. Reality remains indivisible. So first, don't hanker for transcendence. There is no need. Only understanding. Or, if you love the word transcendence, then you can remember, understanding is transcendence. But transcendence is not of the form. The transcendence is of both the surface and depth. Because the moment you see it is all one, then you cannot define it as the surface and you cannot define it as the depth. Then all definitions are meaningless. Then you are facing the indefinable. You have transcended duality. But it comes through understanding. The very idea of transcendence can create problems. You can start repressing. You can start condemning. That's how condemnation entered into human consciousness. And it has been the greatest calamity that man has ever suffered. I have heard a guy went to his dentist. The dentist wanted to give him Novocaine, but he said, no. I want to transcend dental medication. He must be a transcendental meditation freak. He says, I want to transcend dental medication. Why? Why this constant effort to go somewhere else, to be somewhere else, to be someone else? Why can't you relax into reality as it is? There is nowhere to go, nothing to transcend and nothing to transcend to. God is here now. You just understand. Just open your eyes and see. See without any ideas. If you have this idea of transcending something, you are always looking with prejudiced eyes. You know this is the form and you have to transcend the form. How can you love the form? This is the body and you have to love only the soul. And this is the world and you can only love God. You will be getting into an unnecessary anxiety. And the anxiety that you will create is such that you will never be able to solve it. Because the form is always there with the formless. The form is of the formless. Let me be contradictory or paradoxical, but it is so. The form is of the formless, and the body is of the bodiless. And the matter is nothing but non-matter in a condensed form. It is the manifestation. The matter is the manifestation of the non-material. The word is nothing but a manifestation of silence. Rather than trying to transcend, start thinking of relaxing into that which is. You will be sooner reaching into the formless and without any effort on your own to reach it. Just relax and be drowned by the form. And when you are drowned by the form, you start entering into the formless. If you can love a woman or a man, your friend, your wife, your child, your father, your mother, if you can love anybody, soon you will see that the form is not there alone. The formless has started coming through the form. When you touch the hand of somebody you love, it is not only a touch of the skin. Something is touched which is beyond the skin, behind the skin. Some pulse, some vibe simply jumps from one hand to another. Something of the spiritual. Look into the eyes of somebody you love. And you are not looking only into the eyes. Something deeper opens. Something abysmal opens. By and by, the body starts disappearing. You are getting into the spiritual. But the body is the door. It is exactly like a temple. You enter a temple. What do you mean by the word temple? The door, the walls, do you mean that? Of course, the door and the walls are not the temple. The temple is the emptiness inside. That's where you go. But those doors and those walls protect that emptiness, that shrine. If those walls and the doors disappear, there will be no shrine. Those walls are not against that emptiness. Those walls support that emptiness. Those walls protect that emptiness. So, what is the temple? The walls, the doors are the emptiness. No, you cannot divide that way. Both are the temple. The wall and the doors is the outer form. And the emptiness, the innermost emptiness, is the soul. Exactly so is the case with man, with a flower, with a tree. God is there in every form, and God is formless. Because God is formless, the idea arises how to transcend form. But the only way to transcend it is to descend into it. The only way to transcend it is to go into it so totally, so lovingly, that there is no condemnation. Don't even call it the surface, because even our words have become contaminated. The moment you call this is just the surface, you have already condemned it. As if there is something wrong with the surface. You go for a walk on the beach, you see millions of waves in the ocean, on the surface. Yes, this is the surface. But can you take the surface away from the ocean? And can you enter the ocean without entering the surface? The depth and the surface are two polarities of one energy. And the ocean will not be much of an ocean if you take the surface away. Nothing will be left. You will go on taking the surface away, 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 and nothing will be left. Because whenever something will be there, it will become the surface. To see this non-duality is to see. Then one becomes, for the first time, alert, aware. The third question, I want to be creative, what should I do? You become a child again, and you will be creative. All children are creative. Creativity needs freedom. Freedom from the mind. Freedom from knowledge. Freedom from prejudices. A creative person is one who can try the new. A creative person is not a robopath. Robopaths are never creative. They are repetitive. So become a child again. And you will be surprised that all children are creative. All children, wherever they are born, they are creative. But we don't allow their creativity. We crush and kill their creativity. We jump upon them. We start teaching them the right way to do things. Remember, a creative person always goes on trying the wrong ways. If you always follow the right way to do a thing, you will never be creative. Because the right way means discovered by others. And the right way means, of course, you will be able to make something. You will become a producer, a manufacturer. You will be a technician, but you will not be a creator. What is the difference between a producer and a creator? A producer knows the right way of doing a thing, the most economical way of doing a thing, with least effort, he can create more results. He is a producer. A creator fools around. He does not know what is the right way to do a thing. So he goes on seeking and searching again and again in different directions. Many times he moves in a wrong direction. But Wherever he moves, he learns, he becomes more and more rich. He does something which nobody has ever done before. If he had followed the right way to do things, he would not have been able to do it. Listen to this small story. A Sunday school teacher asked her students to draw a picture of the Holy Family. After the pictures were brought to her, she saw that some of the youngsters had drawn the conventional pictures, the Holy Family in the manger, the Holy Family riding on the mule, and the like. But she called up one little boy to ask him to explain his drawing, which showed an aeroplane with four heads sticking out of the plane windows. She said, "I can understand why you drew three of the heads to show Joseph, Mary, and Jesus. But who is this fourth head?" "Ah," answered the boy, "that is Pontius the Pilate." Now, this is beautiful. This is what creativity is. He has discovered something. But only children can do that. You will be afraid to do it. You will look foolish. A creator has to be able to look foolish. A creator has to risk his so-called respectability. That's why you always see poets, painters, dancers, musicians are not very respectable people. And when they become respectable, when a Nobel Prize is given to them, they are no more creative. From that moment, creativity disappears. What happens? Have you ever seen a Nobel Prize winner writing another thing which is of any value? Have you ever seen any respectable person doing something ever creative? He becomes afraid. If he does something wrong, or if something goes wrong, what will happen to his prestige? He cannot afford that. So when an artist becomes respectable, he becomes dead. Only those who are ready to put at stake their prestige, their pride, their respectability, again and again, and can go on into something which nobody thinks is worth going. Creators are always thought to be mad people. The world recognizes them, but very late. It goes on thinking something is wrong. Creators are eccentric people. And remember again, each child is born with all the capacity to become a creator. Without any exception, all children try to be creators, but we don't allow them. Immediately we start teaching them the right way to do a thing. And once they have learned the right way to do a thing, they become robopaths. Then they go on doing the right thing again and again and again. And the more they do it, the more efficient they become. The more efficient they become, the more respected. Somewhere between the age 7 and 14, a great change happens in a child. Psychologists have been searching into the phenomena, why it happens and what happens. You have two minds, two hemispheres. The left hemisphere of the mind is uncreative. It is very technically capable. But as far as creativity is concerned, it is absolutely important. It can do a thing once it has learned, and it can do it very efficiently, perfectly. It is mechanical. This left hemisphere is the hemisphere of reasoning, logic, mathematics. It is the hemisphere of calculation, cleverness, of discipline, order. The right hemisphere is just the opposite to it. It is the hemisphere of chaos, not of order. It is the hemisphere of poetry, not of prose. It is the hemisphere of love, not of logic. It has a great feeling for beauty. It has a great insight into originality. But it is not efficient. It cannot be efficient. The creator cannot be efficient. He has to go on experimenting. The creator cannot settle anywhere. The creator is a vagabond. He carries his tent on his shoulders. Yes, he can stay for an overnight stay, and by the morning he is gone again. That's why I call him a vagabond. He is never a householder. He cannot settle. Settlement means death to him. He is always ready to risk. Risk is his love affair. But this is the right side hemisphere. The right side hemisphere is functioning when the child is born. The left side hemisphere is not functioning. We start teaching the child unknowingly, unscientifically. But down the ages we have learned the trick how to sift the energy from the right hemisphere to the right hemisphere. How to put a stop to the right hemisphere and how to start the left hemisphere. That's what our whole schooling is. From KG to the university. That's what our whole training and so-called education is. It is an effort to destroy the left hemisphere, the right hemisphere, and to help the left hemisphere. Somewhere between the age 7 and 14, we succeed and the child is killed. The child is destroyed. Then the child is no more wild. He becomes a citizen. Then he learns the ways of discipline, language, logic, prose. He starts competing in the school, becomes an egoist. He starts learning all the neurotic things that are prevalent in the society, becomes more interested in power, money, starts thinking how to become more educated so that he can become more powerful, how to have more money, how to have a big house and all that. We shift. Then the right hemisphere functions less and less, or functions only when you are in dream. Fast asleep, or sometimes when you have taken a drug. The great appeal of the drugs in the West is only because the West has succeeded in destroying the right hemisphere completely because of compulsory education. The West has become too much educated. That means it has gone to the very axis, to one side. It has become extremist. Now there seems to be no possibility. Unless You introduce in the universities and colleges and the schools some ways which can help the right hemisphere to revive again. Drugs are not going to go. There is no possibility to prohibit drugs by law alone. There is no way to enforce it unless the inner balance is put right again. The appeal of the drug is that it immediately shifts the gear. From the left hemisphere, your energy moves to the right hemisphere. That's all the drug can do. The alcohol has been doing for centuries. But now far better drugs are available. LSD, marijuana, psilocybin. And far more better drugs will be available in the future. And the criminal is not the drug taker. The criminal is the politician and the educationist. It is they who are guilty. They have forced human mind into one extreme, into such an extreme, that now there is a need to revolt. And the need is so much. Poetry has completely disappeared from people's life. Beauty has disappeared. Love has disappeared. Money, power, pull, they have become their only gods. How can humanity go on living without love and without poetry and without joy and without celebration? Not for long. And the new generation all over the world is doing a great service by sowing the stupidity of your so-called education. It is not a coincidence that drug takers almost always become dropouts. They disappear from the universities, colleges. It is not coincidence. This is part of the same revolt. And once a man has learned the joys of drug, it becomes very difficult for him to drop it. Drugs can be dropped only if better ways can be found which can release your poetry. Meditation is a better way, less destructive, less harmful than any kind of chemical. In fact, not harmful at all. Beneficial. Meditation also does the same thing. It shifts your mind from the left hemisphere to the right hemisphere. It releases your inner capacity of creativity. The world can be avoided, a great calamity that is going to be there through drugs, only by one thing, and that is meditation. There is no other way. If meditation becomes more and more prevalent and enters more and more people's lives, drugs will disappear. And another part is if education starts not to be absolutely against the right hemisphere and its functioning. If the children are taught that both are their minds, and if they are taught how to use both, and if they are taught when to use which, there are situations where only the left side brain is needed, when you need to calculate in the marketplace, in the everyday business of life. And there are times when you need the right hemisphere. And remember always, the right hemisphere is the end and the left hemisphere is the means. The left hemisphere has to serve the right hemisphere. The right hemisphere is the master. Because you earn money only because you want to enjoy your life and celebrate your life. You want a certain bank balance only so that you can love. You work only so that you can play. Play remains the goal. You work only so that you can relax. Relaxation remains the goal. Work is not the goal. The work ethics is a hangover from the past. It has to be dropped. And the educational world has to go through a real revolution. People should not be forced. Children should not be forced into repetitive patterns. What your education is, have you ever looked about it? Have you ever pondered over it? It is simply a training in memory. You don't become intelligent through it. You become more and more unintelligent. You become stupid. Each child enters the school very intelligent. And it is very rarely that a person comes from the university and is still intelligent. It is very rare. The university almost always succeeds. Yes, you come with degrees. But those degrees you have purchased at a great cost. You have lost your intelligence. You have lost your joy. You have lost life. Because you have lost the functioning of the right side hemisphere. And what you have learned, information. Your mind is full of memory. You can repeat. You can reproduce. That's what your examinations are. The person is thought to be very intelligent if he can vomit all that has been thrown into him. First he has to be forced to swallow. Go on swallowing. And then in the examination papers, vomit. If you can vomit efficiently, you are intelligent. If you can vomit exactly that which has been given to you, you are intelligent. Now this is something to be understood. You can vomit the same thing only if you have not digested it, remember. If you have digested it, you cannot vomit the same thing. Something else will come. Blood may come, but not the same Vrindavan bread. That will not come. It has disappeared. So you have to simply keep it down there in your stomach without digesting it. Then you are thought to be very, very intelligent. The most stupid is thought to be the most intelligent. It is a very sorry thing, sorry state of things. The intelligent may not fit. Do you know, Albert Einstein could not pass the matriculation. Such a creative intelligence. It was difficult for him to behave in a stupid way as everybody was behaving. All your so-called gold medalists in the schools, colleges, universities disappear. They never prove of any use. Their glory ends with their gold medals. Then they are never found anywhere. Life owes nothing to them. What happens to these people? You have destroyed them. They have purchased the certificates. And they have lost all. Now they will be carrying their certificates and degrees. This kind of education has to be totally transformed. More joy has to be brought to the schoolroom. More chaos has to be brought to the university. More dance, more song, more poetry, more creativity, more intelligence. So much dependence on memory has to be dropped. People should be watched and people should be helped to become more intelligent. When a person responds in a new way, he should be valued. There should be no right answers. There is none. There is only a stupid answer and an intelligent answer. The very categorization of right and wrong is wrong. There is no right answer. And there is no wrong answer. Either the answer is stupid, repetitive, or the answer is creative, responsive, intelligent. And even if the repetitive answer seems to be right, it has not to be valued much because it is repetitive. And even though the intelligent answers may not be perfectly right, may not fit with the old ideas, it has to be praised because it is new. It shows intelligence. You ask me, I want to be creative, what should I do? Undo all that the society has done to you. Undo all that your teachers and your parents have done to you. Undo all that the policeman and the politician and the priest has done to you. And you will again become creative. You will again have that thrill that you had in the very beginning. It is still waiting there, repressed. It can uncoil. And when that creative energy uncoils in you, you are religious. To me, a religious person is one who is a creative person. And everybody is born creative. And very few people remain. It is for you to come out of the trap. You can come. Of course, you will need great courage. Because when you start undoing what the society has done to you, you will lose respect. You will not be thought to be respectable. You will start becoming bizarre. You will look bizarre to people. You will look a freak. People will think something has gone wrong with the poor man. This is the greatest courage. To go into a life where people start thinking that you are bizarre. Difficulties will be there. You can ask Indivar, he has come from Australia. He was a renowned psychoanalyst there for 20 years. And now he is in such a difficulty. The wife thinks that he has gone mad. Children have become suspicious that the dad has gone mad. The colleagues are no more in sympathy. There is no question of respect, even sympathy is missing. The bosses where he works in the clinic are ready to throw him any moment. And for the first time he is happy. And for the first time he is doing something that he enjoys. And for the first time something from the right hemisphere is released in him. Just the other night he was there. And when I touched his head, I could feel the shift. It is no more the left hemisphere. It is the right hemisphere where more energy is moving. His poetry is coming back. He is becoming a child again. But naturally, you have to risk. If you want to be creative, you will have to risk all. But it is worth. A little creativity is more worth than this whole world and its kingdom. The joy that comes by creating something new, whatsoever it is, a small song, a small painting, anything. When you create something new, you participate with creators, because God is the creator. When you create, you are in tune with God. When you create, really, God creates through you. That's why great joy arises. When you repeat alone. God is not there. You are a desert. You are a machine. When you create, God simply enters in your heart. You become a hollow bamboo and he starts playing on you and you become a flute. A great song is possible and everybody is carrying that song. And unless that song is sung, you will never feel fulfilled. My sannyas is nothing but an initiation into creativity, initiation into danger, initiation into a new kind of life that has not been taught to you, in fact, against which everything has been taught to you. My whole struggle is against this so-called neurotic society. I would like you to become uneducated again. The fourth question, why is it so difficult to find oneself? Because you have been turned outwards. Your eyes have become paralyzed. They can only see the without. You cannot turn back. Your neck is no more flexible. You cannot go in your being. All that you know takes you outside. You are very, very efficient in thinking. Thinking takes you outside. To go in, to know oneself, non-thinking is needed. Now that seems impossible. The whole life's training to think has got such a fixed structure inside you that even when you don't need to think, you go on thinking. You would like to sit silently, but the mind goes on chattering. You have practiced that chattering too long. It has gone into your blood. That's why it looks difficult. Otherwise, that is the easiest thing in the world. The easiest has to be that. Because yourself is closest to you than anything else. If you want to know somebody else, it is a long way journey. If you want to know God, one never knows where he is hiding. And where to find him and what is his address. But if you want to know yourself, there should be no problem at all. You are yourself. If you cannot know even this, where you already are, where you exist, then what else you can do? And what else you can know? Self-knowledge should be the easiest thing. But it has become difficult because you have been trained to focus your eyes on the outside. I have heard Sherlock Holmes arrived in heaven. The angels turned out en masse to meet him. The Lord himself descended from his throne to bid him welcome. Holmes, he said, we have a little mystery up here that you may be able to help us solve. Adam and Eve seem to have disappeared. Nobody has been able to look at them for aeons. If you could possibly uncover them for us. Holmes darted to the fringe of the assemblage and hauled to frighten and surprise angels before the Lord. Here they are, he said. Adam and Eve admitted their identities. We got tired of being stared at and asked for autographs by every darn new angel who came up here. They explained, we assumed aliases and these simple disguises and got away with them for centuries until this smarty pants ferreted us out. How did you do it, marveled the Lord. Elementary, my dear Lord, said Holmes. They were the only two who had no Nevilles. Yes, to know oneself is very elementary. It is not difficult. It can't be difficult. You have just to unlearn the ways. You need not learn anything to know who you are. You have only to unlearn few things. First, you have to unlearn being concerned with things. Second, you have to unlearn being concerned with thoughts. Yes. And the third thing happens on its own accord, witnessing. Let me tell you in this way. These are the three things in your life. On the outermost fringe are things, the world, what Zen people call the world of 10,000 things. On the outermost fringe, the periphery, the circumference, are things, millions of things. Then, between the center and the circumference, there are thoughts, desires, dreams, memories, imaginations, the mind. If the world is called the world of 10,000 things, then the mind should be called the world of 10 million thoughts. And the key is one. First you start watching things. Sitting silently, look at a tree and just be watchful. Don't think about it. Don't say, what kind of tree is this? Whether it is beautiful or ugly. Don't say it is green or dry. Don't make any thought ripple about it. Just go on looking at the tree. That's what down the centuries meditators have been doing. They will choose one thing, maybe a small flame of a lamp, and they will sit silently looking at it. What they were doing? The flame has nothing to do with meditation. It is just a device. They were trying one thing, to go on looking at the flame and come to a point where no thought arises about the flame. The flame is there, you are here, and no thought arises. You can do it anywhere, watching anything. Just remember one thing, when the thought comes, put it aside. Shove it aside. Again go on looking at the thing. In the beginning it will be difficult, but after a period, intervals start happening. There will come moments when you will be looking at the tree and there will be no thought. And you will find great joy arising out of that simple experience. Nothing has happened. Just thoughts are not there, and the tree is there, and you are there. And between two, there is space. The space is not cluttered with thoughts. Suddenly great joy. For no visible reason. For no reason at all. You have learned the first secret. This then has to be used on a subtler way. The things are grasped. That's why I say start with the thing. You can sit in your room. You can go on looking at a photograph. Just the only thing to remember is not to think about it. Just look without any thinking. Slowly, slowly it happens. Look at the table without thinking. And by, the table is there, you are there, and no thoughts between you two. And suddenly joy. Joy is a function of thoughtlessness. Joy is already there. It is repressed behind so many thoughts. When thoughts are not there, it starts surfacing. Start with the grass. Then, when you have become attuned and you started feeling movements, when thought disappears and only things are there, then it starts doing the second thing. Now close your eyes and look at any thought that comes by without thinking about the thought. Some face arises on the screen of your mind. Or a cloud moves. Or anything. Just look at it without thinking. This will be a little harder than the first. Because things are more grass. Thoughts are very subtle. But if the first has happened, the second will happen. Just time will be needed. Go on looking at the thought. After a time being, it depends on you. It can happen within weeks, it can happen within months, it can take years. It depends on you how intently, how wholeheartedly you are doing it. Then one day suddenly, the thought is not there. You are alone. With the thing, thoughts disappeared, you were there and the thing was there. Subject and object too were there. Duality was there. When the thought disappears, you are simply left alone. Only subjectivity is left alone. And great joy will arise. Thousandfold greater than the first joy that had happened when the tree was there and the thought has disappeared. Thousandfold. So immense, you will be flooded with joy. This is the second step. When this has started happening, then do the third thing. Watch the watcher. Now there is no object. Things have been dropped, thoughts have been dropped. Now you are alone. Now simply be watchful of this watcher. Be a witness to this witnessing. In the beginning, it will be difficult again. Because we know only how to watch something, a thing, a thought. Even a thought is at least something to watch. Now there is nothing. It is absolute emptiness. Only the watcher is left alone. You have to turn upon yourself. This is what Jesus means when he says conversion, turning upon oneself. This is what Mahavira means when he says pratikraman, turning upon oneself. This is what Patanjali means when he calls pratyahara, turning upon oneself. And this is what Sufis mean when they use the word sahada, witnessing the witness. This is the secret most key. You just go on being there alone. Rest in this aloneness. And a moment comes when this happens. It is bound to happen. If the first two things have happened, the third is bound to happen. You need not worry about it. When this happens, then for the first time you know what joy is. All those joys that you had known before. The joy that had happened when the tree was there and the thought has disappeared. And the joy that had happened when the thoughts had disappeared and you were left alone. Yes, the second joy was thousandfold greater than the first. But now something happens which is not only quantitatively different but is qualitatively different. Now for the first time you know what Hindus call ananda, the real joy. All joys known before simply pale out. Simply don't mean anything anymore. Those joys were something that were happening to you. Now this joy is utterly different. This is you yourself. This is Swabhava. This is your innermost nature. It is not something happening to you, so it cannot be taken away. It is you in your authentic being. It is your very being. Now it cannot be taken away. Now there is no way to lose it. You have come home. So you have to unlearn things, thoughts. First wash the grass, then wash the subtle, and then wash the beyond. That is beyond the grass and the subtle. The fifth question, Bhagwan, do you find your jokes funny or are you catering for our sense of humor? P.S. We love them. To me, the whole life is a joke. And I find everything funny. It is all so ridiculous. But remember, I am not catering for your sense of humor. I never cater for you in any way. And if I tell a joke, that is simply a trick. Because that is the only moment when you open your mouth. I can help you swallow something. That is just a device. Your mouth is open and you are unaware. I can throw in something. It really goes. Your mind is no more functioning. Your thoughts are no more there. When you laugh, the mind disappears. In a laughter, mind cannot exist. For a moment, there is a gap. And I seek that gap. That gap is of tremendous importance. Because only through that gap I can make a contact with you. The last question. I want to surrender and yet... This is how the human mind functions. It is always contradictory. It wants one thing and at the same time, it is afraid. The mind can never be total. The mind's existence is in division. So if you are waiting to surrender only when your mind will totally say yes, then it is not going to happen. at the most you can hope only one thing. If your miser mind is saying, go ahead, then go ahead. Listen to the miser and don't be bothered by the miner. Sometimes just the contrary happens. People go on being bothered by the minor part of their mind. One day, somebody was saying to me that 90% I am ready to take sannyas. 90%. I said, man, this is a miracle. 90%? You don't wait any moment because who knows? You just take sannyas. He said, but that 10% mind, what am I to do about it? It goes on saying no. So I will have to wait. But that man is not aware that even to decide to wait is a choice. To take sannyas is a choice. Not to take it is also a choice. You cannot choose not to choose. That freedom is not given. You cannot choose not to choose. You are choosing every moment. You have to remain a chooser. Man is not free not to choose, remember. But you can create an illusion that man is thinking that he is not choosing yet because the 10% mind is saying no. But he is choosing in favor of the 10%. He is not taking sannyas. He is going against the 90% for the 10%. This is stupid. At least be a little democratic. Don't wait for the totality. Mind is never total. And when there is totality, mind disappears. In fact, you are trying to surrender so that you can be total. Now, if you demand totality as a requirement to surrender, then you are just being absolutely absurd. I have heard about an old church. The church was so ancient and the building was falling. A small wind will come and the building will start shaking. People have stopped coming to it. They were afraid. Then the committee, the board of the directors met. Even they didn't meet inside the church. It was dangerous to go in. They met outside. And they decided something has to be done now. People have stopped coming. Even the priest won't go in. And it can fall any moment. It is a miracle why it has not fallen now, up to now. What should we do? But the orthodox mind, the old people were there, they said, this is an ancient church and we cannot demolish it. And there were new people and they said, we have to demolish it, otherwise this will kill someday somebody. And we have to make a new church. And there was great conflict, what to do? And then they decided for a compromise. They decided first, they passed a resolution that we decide that the new church has to be built. Second, we decide that the old church has to be demolished. Third, we decide that the new church should be made exactly like the old, exactly on the same spot. And all the material from the old church should be used in the new church. Nothing new will be used. So it remains ancient. And fourth, till the new is ready, we will go on using the old. Now how it is going to happen? Compromises don't help. If you want to surrender, then just watch inside yourself. If your major mind is ready, then take the jump. A Russian commissar was so discouraged with life in Moscow that he decided to commit suicide. One evening he walked out to the country, a loaf of bread tugged under his arm. When he came to a train junction, he laid down on the railroad tracks. A peasant passing by was amazed by the strange sight. "What are you doing?" he asked. "Lying on these tracks?" Said the commissar, "I am going to commit suicide." "What do you need the bread for then?" asked the peasant. The commissar answered, "In this country, by the time the train gets here, a man could starve to death." But this is how the mind functions. You are ready to commit suicide. I used to live in a house by the side of a professor. We were colleagues in the same university. I was very new, and the first night I became a little worried because the professor and his wife started fighting. And the fight continued, and I could hear everything that was going on. And I was not even introduced to them. So it would be an interference, a trespass to go in the middle of the night into their house. So I had to just wait and see what is happening. And then finally the professor threatened that he will go and commit suicide. Then I became a little worried. I came out. The professor has left. The wife was standing there, just closing the door. I said to the woman, "What is the matter? Can I be of any help?" She said, "You don't be worried. This must be the 100th time. He will take a good walk and come back. He never commits suicide. And he threatens every time." And just within 5 or 7 minutes, he was back. And I asked him, "So soon, have you committed?" He said, "The railroad is so far away. And it is raining, can't you see? And I don't have any umbrella." Mind is like that. It goes on thinking in contradictions. The young man poured out his heart's devotion on paper as he wrote to the girl of his dreams. "Darling, I would climb the highest mountain, swim the widest stream, cross the burning desert, die at the stake for you. P.S. I will see you on Saturday if it doesn't rain." Now drop that yet. If you really want to surrender, surrender. If you feel the yet is more strong, then forget about it. Then that is not the right moment for you. The mind continues to be contradictory because that is its trick to survive. And that's its way to keep you always discontented. You want to do one thing, one part of your mind says do, another part says don't do. If you do it, the other part which was not in favor will go on condemning it and will go on saying it was worthless, and I was telling you from the very beginning. And you will become frustrated. If you don't do it, the part that wanted to do it will go on chattering to you that do it, you are missing something great. Why don't you do it? Either way, you remain frustrated. And mind is always happy if you go on only thinking. Do anything and mind becomes afraid. Because when you do something, you are committed. You get involved. Mind wants utter freedom to dream, desire, long. Have you watched this phenomenon in you? If not, then watch. Whenever you are thinking of doing something, there are 1001 alternatives. Mind has great freedom. For example, if you want to purchase a car, you can go to the showroom. You have many alternatives. Many kinds of cars are available. You can purchase this or that, you can dream about all. But you can purchase only one. The moment you purchase, if there were 100 cars, then you have chosen out of 100 cars. You have missed 99. And that is going to make you miserable. Now your mind has only one car. And your mind will start finding all kinds of faults with it. And the remaining parts of the mind who wanted to have other cars will start telling you, I was saying from the very beginning. So a man remains continuously frustrated. Whatsoever you do brings frustration. Because doing always closes your freedom. It becomes a commitment. Without doing anything, you are free to choose, because you choose only in the mind. You can change and alter and do this and that. This morning you are going to purchase this, by the evening another thing, and you can go on playing. That's why thinkers are not known to do many things. They don't do at all. They only think. And without doing anything, you cannot attain. You will have to do something. You will have to have the courage to commit, to get involved somewhere. Otherwise, you can sit and go on thinking and dreaming. That is all futile, meaningless, a sheer wastage of energy. So either decide to do it or decide not to do it, but don't hang in between. Be decisive. Decisiveness is always good. It creates integration. It brings integration. It makes you more crystallized. Enough for today.